This is the Roots of Rock monthly jam session. Here's your host, Sean Tompkins.
Hey, I'm Sean Tompkins. Welcome to the April 2018 Roots of Rock monthly jam session. As you may or may not know, the jam sessions are a collection of all kinds of stuff going on in the Rogers rock world. Usually, it's a chance for me to get really deep into albums, maybe full interview chats with guests, whatever we feel like, to be honest. And this month's show, I had so much fun getting to make this one. I have fun making all of them, but on this one, I got together with my good buddy, the Vince of Rock, and we did a complete dissection of Pearl Jam's debut album, 10. Vince is a huge Pearl Jam fan, and so am I. So we spent weeks combing the web, reading books, listening to the music, and digging for all sorts of cool trivia and stories, and dissecting the lyrical content, the songwriting process, everything to do with this album. As usual, though, we're going to throw to Poncho Parker for a Rock Flash update to find out what is happening in the world of rock today, and then we're going to get to that album dissection. Poncho?
Linkin Park vocalist Mike Shinoda talked about the songwriting process for his upcoming solo album. Said it started in a really dark place. I wasn't leaving my house. It was very claustrophobic having lost one of my closest friends. I felt very lost. He added, life was difficult, but music was easy. The music made things easier. Metallica and the San Francisco Giants had their sixth annual Metallica Night on Monday in San Francisco. Members of the band were on hand to start things off right with the national anthem and first pitch, sticking around all night to cheer on the team against the Nationals. Drummer Lars threw out the first pitch. Guitarist Kirk Hammett took to the diamond for a rendition of the national anthem. A portion of the proceeds from every Metallica Night ticket sold will benefit the band's All Within My Hands Foundation. Metallica has always kept strong ties to the Bay Area sports scene. The band has also performed before Golden State Warriors basketball games and San Jose Sharks hockey games. The Guns N' Roses July 24th show at the football stadium in Iceland will be the largest concert ever held in the entire country. It will take around 1 week to prepare the stadium, including renovations to the venue itself. 35 containers are required to ship equipment to Iceland, and a staff of 150 will accompany the band. I'm Poncho. That's your Rock Flash.
You are listening to Roots of Rock, podcast edition. And on this segment, I've got a good friend of mine, good friend of the show, Troy Vincent, otherwise known as the Vince of Rock. Mm-hmm. Vince, welcome to Roots of Rock yet again.
Thanks for having me, buddy. I really appreciate this. I'm glad that you dug me up for this project.
Well, I know you're passionate like music, as am I, and as are a lot of people, and especially about the band we're going to talk about today. I had this idea a little while back to do kind of a classic album dissection, and it seems strange to call this a classic album, but I think it is a classic album. Safe to say that it is classic at this point.
They're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so I think that qualifies right there.
I remember an uncle of mine telling me one time, you know you've gotten old when people start to consider the music you grew up with as classic.
Yeah.
And the Seattle scene, the 90s music, that all became classic a long time ago, actually.
I walked through Walmart the other day and saw a Nirvana shirt. A Nirvana shirt in Walmart. I did not think I would ever see that day, but no, here's a throwback to a classic band from the ancient time known as the 90s. Thanks.
I had a kid once at SAIT when I was going to school to get into radio. This was like 2005, 2006, he used to refer to me as the classic rocker in the class.
Yeah, you like that 90s stuff, hey? Hey, old fella.
Hey, dude. Right on, rock on, dude. We are talking about Pearl Jam's classic album, 10. And my idea at the time was to do, a lot of people have talked about classic albums. They've dug into the history. There's known stories. So I wanted a bit of a twist on this dissection. What I wanted to do was take two people and each person picks a song, an alternate song. So one person takes 1, 3, 5, 7, whatever. And the other person takes 2, 4, 6, 8. And each of us tries to dig up whatever kind of cool stuff we could about each song. I had three albums to choose from. One was DNR's Appetite for Destruction. Mm-hmm. The other was Nirvana's In Utero.
Great album.
And the third, Pearl Jam's 10.
Yeah.
We had a bit of email back and forth, and you chose 10. Why?
Well, I hope that you invite me to do the other two at some point as well, because those are just great albums, along with the one that we've gone with here with 10 from Pearl Jam. I went with this one because, A, it requires the least amount of work. Because I can sing every guitar strum, every bass riff, every drum beat, every piano note,
right?
Every lyric. This album is in my DNA.
Uh-huh.
I've never done the Ancestry.com thing, but if they did, it'd come back and be like, you are part Pearl Jam. You are this much percent, 10% Pearl Jam for the 10 album. I'm like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. So I think that's why it was a reflex to kind of go with this album for me.
That would be great. That we should delve more into that. Like, if you're what is your musical DNA, and have the percentage of your DNA.
Musicancestry.com.
<That's right.
laughs> Someone's going to hear this and be like, okay, thank you for the $1 million idea, guys. And then
that's right.
Create
yeah.
It and,
let's get on that before someone else.
And we're still poor. Yeah.
I chose this album because I know it's a classic, but for me, and I love this album, but for me, I would say, you know, half of the songs, maybe three quarters of the songs, I know really well. There's all the hits. There's Alive, Jeremy, Even Flow. I mean, everybody knows those.
Mm-hmm.
But the first CD that I ever got was their next album, was the Pearl Jam Versus album. So that one, I used to fall asleep to that for pretty much a year straight. And so this one I know, but it was really interesting to go back and get to dig into the history and find out who played what, who wrote what it was about. I have never done that for this album before. It's just really cool to go back where when I was younger, I just listened to it and it was more of an experience. I would just experience the music rather than dissect it. So it's cool to go back as an almost 40-year-old and dissect it. It was a really fun experience for me.
And having access to information like we do now compared to back then as well allows you to be able to do that in more depth.
And yeah, that's a good point. It's one thing I've noticed from having done Roots of Rock for a couple of years now. The further you go back, the less information and documented stories there are about the original artists. I mean, there's, you know, everybody knows the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or something. And there's obviously a lot been said and done about the Beatles and Elvis and those guys. But the farther you go back, that's just the less recording technology and mechanisms there were at that time. Whereas bands from the 90s and on, I mean, it's endless. You almost have to sort through the stuff you want to use rather than the stuff you don't want to use, because there's just so many books and podcasts and movies and websites and fan sites. I mean, it's pretty cool.
True.
Yeah. So we're going to do a little history on the album. There's some known stories of the Pearl Jam lore. And the start of this album was Eddie Vedder was living in San Diego in 1990. His buddy Jack Irons gave him a tape from a band that didn't have a drummer or a singer at the point. He told Eddie that he couldn't join them at the time, but he thought Eddie might be interested. Eddie dubbed three songs onto a tape and sent them back to the band. And those three songs would later become Alive, Once, and
Footsteps.
Footsteps. Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to that at the end. I've got that on there, but let's keep that in mind. Footsteps. A month or so after Eddie Vedder records that demo, for lack of a better word, he was in Seattle jamming with Stone Gossard, Mike McCready, and Dave Crewson on the songs that would eventually become 10.
All cruising on the drums, man. Cruising. He could wail on the drums. So he had the problems with the alcohol, so had to leave the band. And says he has no regrets. It was the right decision, you know, for them to part ways. And,
right.
Yeah.
And when Eddie joined, they were called Mookie Blaylock,
yeah,
named for a famous basketball player. The guys in Pearl Jam, all big basketball fans. And
you wouldn't think to look at them that they're out jamming some basketball, slamming down some buckets while they're not, okay, you lay down that track there, Mike, and we're going to be outside here doing some horse.
That's right. I'm working on my vert out here.
And I'm not working on my scales. I'm working on my vert. Yeah,
just in case. I'm coming close to dunking, but
this album doesn't work out. I have other plans.
So a really cool thing that I didn't realize. I'm not a huge basketball guy. I like basketball, but not a huge basketball guy. But they changed the name of the band for fear that they might get sued by Mookie Blaylock.
Mm-hmm.
But they did keep a bit of a tribute in there, and his number was 10, which is why they called the album 10.
And it took me way too long to find out that it was called after his number.
Right.
Because I remember you would get the album, you'd be like, 10. Okay. And you're trying to piece it together. Why 10? There's 11 songs. Why 10? You unfold the liner and it's got the guys and they're all kind of going up in a big cheer, like a high five. And
yeah.
You're like, 10 hands? No, you can't see the 10 hands. 10 feet. And I'm looking, I'm counting the feet. And like, there's 9. Son of a, why 10? Why 10?
The things that tortured you in the 90s, right?
The things that were so important to know.
Now it tortures you, but for like 8 seconds. Yeah. It tortures you for the length of time it takes you to pull out your phone and Google it.
Yeah, I wonder why it's called 10, because there's 11 songs. Okay, there's the answer, done.
It is cool, though. I love finding out those nuggets. That's really cool.
But it had to spread through word of mouth back in the day. And then you had to take everything with a grain of salt, because if it took that long to get to you, how has the story twisted along the way? To get to you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard to believe anything that you heard. Although some stuff, there were grains of truth to it.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of accuracy in a lot of the stuff.
And it's amazing some things that actually survived that game of telephone and turned out to be true. So we're going to get to, we are limited in the podcast form to 30-second clips of the song. So we can't play the whole song, but we've got some clips. So we're going to play the clips, listen to them, and then we're going to start talking about the song. So the first one was Once, and that was yours. So let's hear it. So
when it comes to Once, it made me think, I thought you were going to start off the shoot. You were going to take Master and Slave, that little intro, the interlude at the beginning. And then, of course, they bookended the album with that.
Right.
The Master Slave, it kind of sets the tone for the album, this unnatural transition I found into the first track. You know, you got this.
I have it, actually.
Yeah?
Can I play it?
You play the little beginning of it? That, yeah. That sounds exactly the same the way I did it.
That's pretty good.
All right, so that was better. But it kind of lulls you into this little zen kind of thing, like you're just, everything's just moving along. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden, these tinny guitars come in, and to me, I liken it to like a siren, like down the road in the distance. Like you hear this, and it kind of catches your attention. And it gets closer and closer, and that's how the song Once kind of starts off. And then all of a sudden, just boom, there it is. And
it hits you.
And it's in your face.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the punch that they come in with that.
I agree, yeah. They do a lot of that throughout the album. It's that kind of, loud, quiet, loud is the saying, but it's the quiet, loud, quiet, or the quiet, loud in this case. I didn't realize that was happening when I was young and first experiencing this, but I now, looking back with a bit more experience, I realize how much of a difference dynamics make in music. When I was younger, I really just liked the heavy, fast music. It's got to be heavy, fast, and hard all the time. And I really appreciate the dynamics in music now, and I realize how much it sucks you in, especially if you want to slap someone in the face.
Yeah.
You suck them in, and kind of, like you say, it's just this, it's quiet, it's soft, it's melodic, and all of a sudden, wham.
Hey, come here. I got to tell you something. Lean in. A little closer. Come here. A little closer.
Yeah.
Get out of my face!
Why are you so close to me?
But what I liked about that song is if you listen to the intro and the way it bleeds into each other, it's not like this harmonious melding thing. You know, they don't match up and sync up. Mm-hmm. The timing is off and different. And to me, that kind of is quintessential for the album, for me anyway, my experience of it and how it stretched my ear. Mm-hmm. And it took time for me to really get into the album itself. I didn't love this album out of the chute.
No.
I thought it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, the third time you're like, that's pretty good. Fifth time, you're like, really good. 10th time, this is legendary.
This is now in my DNA.
Yeah. Your ear had to be, my ear anyway, had to be stretched. And to me, that's a sign of, you know, a good album.
Does the intro, it reminded me of In the Air Tonight.
Oh,
is it not similar?
Yeah.
I got a little clip. Can I play it?
Yeah, please do.
Let's hear the intro again, just a bit of it. Okay. The drum beat, at least.
Yeah.
You look like you look dubious.
No, I was just I was just thinking about
it always reminded me of that. I don't know why.
I wonder if someone ever like put it on and, you know, someone's dad was like, "Hey, are you listening to Genesis down there from your room? You can crank that one up, boy."
let me put my ear a little closer to the speaker, son.
I didn't know you were into dad's music. Oh, wait, what's this? What's this loudness? What's this once upon a time stuff? What, 16 gauge? I don't know if I approve of these lyrics.
I wonder if, though, it does. It's always struck me as very similar. Well, obviously, the rest of the song and the whole album, there's nothing close to that. But you never know. You never know where influences come from. And the things that I'm constantly surprised about, things that people are influenced by, and who knows?
And sometimes it's on purpose, and sometimes it's completely.
It just happens. Yeah,
absolutely. And then with that little tease, I mean, we'll get into the actual Master Slave, I guess, is the hidden track a little bit later as well, and talk about that. But Once is the little mini opera that you talked about, that little trilogy where Eddie got the cassette of five songs and he heard it, and then he goes out surfing and he writes lyrics for three of them, records them, and sends them back. And so it was a little mini opera. He's got his character.
Right.
Where Alive is actually part one.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is out of sequence. He'd given us part two right out of the hop. I guess they want, you know, some oomph.
Right.
And so it's the story of just a guy sliding into madness. And you can really get a sense of that, of how it punches in real quick and then trying to like control himself, where you got the little palm mute on the rhythms of it, and, mm-hmm. and then just can't hold back. Primal Eddie comes out,
yeah,
with the big guitars, and it sounds great.
You know, and that's the one thing that I've noticed about this album. Again, when I experienced it when I was younger, it was different, and it was different than anything I'd heard. At least the, you know, say like the Soundgardens, the Nirvana, and the Pearl Jams of the world. But of those three, I would have always classified Pearl Jam as the least heavy, or not heavy, the least dark in their lyrics and their themes. But now that, you know, you get into that stuff and you start reading it, it's a pretty dark album.
Yeah, when the first song's about a serial killer, you know.
Yeah, they're setting the theme for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Shall we move on to Even Flow?
Let's do it.
Or anything else on Once?
I saw a quip about people trying to dissect the meanings of songs, and I don't try to do that too often, but a lot of people actually commented on how the line, hand in my pocket, so determined, discreet. A lot of people thought they were talking about pocket pool, like this guy's playing pocket pool. And I'm like, what? You perverts. That's what you took from that line? That's not what I got out of it. But okay, whatever works for you guys.
It's amazing how different people interpret meanings of songs. And, you know, it's something I wanted to talk about actually during this is, it's something that I think I've noticed recently is a lot of today's music is a lot more literal. I think there's less poetry in today's music.
Oh, absolutely.
And when there's, you know, like you'll hear it and it's really just descriptive of some experience that happened, like whatever, you know, I took a pill in Ibiza. It's like I kissed a girl, you know. It's very literal. It's like, this is what happened to me. And there's not as much left to interpretation. That's speaking in mainstream, you know, pop, yeah, and whatnot. But in these days, in this style of music, I mean, Nirvana's music was a lot like that too, Pearl Jam. It's very poetic. And I think that leaves a lot more to be interpreted by the listener. I like that. I really do.
Absolutely. And I don't mind when some stuff is on the nose and it works. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, once upon a time, there used to be, you know, codes and euphemisms and stuff like that. Now they just say, I want you to take off your clothes. Yeah, take your clothes off.
Yeah.
But before, you would have to dress it up in some sort of,
sure,
phrase that would be like, I'm insinuating this.
Yeah, that's right.
You got to read between the lines.
That's right. Yeah. And I always identify with a more
poetic way of emoting, if you want to put it that way, like just a way of expressing yourself. I always interpret it, or I always identify more with something poetic because I think it allows me to interpret it the way that I want to. If I don't have that experience where I'm not thinking, you know, the exact same thing that's happened to that person, I can't identify with that song as much.
If you live exactly in that world, you're right. Then, yeah. Oh, it's on the spot and you love that song,
yeah.
Or you just flat out love the story or the idea. Yes, absolutely. But you're right. If the more poetic it is, more little hidden it is, the more accessible it is to the masses.
Right.
Because you can get something that relates to you better than something else.
I mean, a serial killer playing pocket pool, I can identify with that. Who can?
I never took that away from the song, but, you know, I had different reasons for I guess, drifting towards that song and liking certain lyrics, but that wasn't it for me. You're right.
Even flow. Interesting thing about this song, for anybody who plays guitar, I guess, is it's written in drop D.
Good old drop D.
Good old drop D.
The first time I discovered drop D, and I was like, what a new world I'm living in now. And you start to race and find out all the other drop D songs and start jamming on those.
That's right. Yeah, drop D, of course, being where you, guitars typically tuned E, A, D, G, B, E. I had to think about that for a second.
I'm not even sure if you did that right. I need to visualize it in my head.
Low to high.
I need
E,
to hold
A,
guitar.
D, G, D, B,
you take the
E.
Top string, you right. Drop it from E down to D. That's all you need to know.
And then it makes it easier in some ways. And it gives makes it a little sludgier, a little looser, a little more grit to it.
Alice in Chains, really good drop.
Yeah.
D. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. Dave Kirsten on drums, Eddie on vocals, Stone Gossard and Mike McCready on guitar, and Jeff Ament on bass. Music by Stone Gossard, lyrics by Eddie Vedder. That's a theme throughout the album. For a lot of it, it varies from that on some, obviously, but they're in the early days, they were the sort of the songwriting duo from that perspective, I think.
And that was it for Stone. You know, his way of dealing with the loss of their previous singer in Mother Love Bone, Andrew Wood. He just started writing a lot, and he wanted to record it, and he brought in Jeff Ament from the same band to say, hey, can you help me out and lay down some tracks? And so that's why you see a lot of this music is written by him, because he's stockpiled a bunch of riffs and stuff like that, and then like let Eddie, the lyricist, the wizard of words, go ahead and slap everything you can. He comes up with stuff so fast, I'll talk about it a little bit later, that mesmerizes the band.
Right.
And so they don't even have time to try and help out with the songwriting lyrically because Eddie's just got it done.
Let's just have this done so that when we give it to him, it's done because we can't keep up.
Yeah. But when it comes to this song in particular, what strikes me, it used to be a joke amongst us friends would be, they named the album 10 as referring to the number of words you can actually understand in this song. Because there tends to be a little bit of mumbling, it feels like. And remember a throwback to SNL with Opera Man, Adam Sandler as Opera Man?
Yes,
giving his
of
little
course.
Eddie Vedder,
yeah.
Even flow. Yeah,
that. Classic.
So it had a reputation of like that. Once you know the lyrics, it's like crystal clear.
Sure.
It's absolutely a brilliant song. And once you know it, you can't like unhear the words.
Right.
I think of it like a 3D picture. Remember those popular 3D
pictures? Yeah.
That fad?
This is all throwbacks to the 90s.
And you would stare at this little pattern on this thing. You're like, oh, I can't see the picture. It'll come to you. And sometimes it came to easy to people and others. For me, it struggled. Once I learned how to do it, they came fast.
Right.
But once that picture pops, you know exactly what's there and you
once
can
you
see it.
And
it's so clear and it's so cool.
Sure.
That's what that song was, I found lyrically for me. Once you know the words, you're like, it's ingenious. And it's about homelessness.
Right.
And which, you know, the roots of Seattle right there. It's quintessential Seattle.
Absolutely.
You go there and see the tent village down by the docks.
Yeah, he's writing about what he could see. And again, it was, you know, fairly poetic in the lyrics and whatnot. It's a little bit more direct, but there's still some poetry in there, I think.
Yeah.
One thing that, interesting bit of trivia that I found out about this song, Dave Crewson had a real hard time in the recording studio recording this song.
Oh, yeah?
And they actually all admitted that this was the hardest song for them to get recorded because he was having such a... Get this is funny because on a song called Even Flow, he had a really hard time getting it to flow evenly. He couldn't keep the a constant tempo and it kept changing. And so I think it was Jeff Ament that actually mentioned that it took them something like, they guessed between a 50 to 100 tries to record this thing because wow. he was having such a hard time getting it right.
I'm actually surprised. You tell that story, I'm surprised they didn't just like reverse the lyrics and go, we're renaming this one Uneven Flow. Don't be perfect on this one, Cruz, and just do your choppy drumming and we'll release it.
They actually recorded because they never were fully happy with the version with Dave Crewson, so they actually re-recorded it for the soundtrack for the 1992 film Singles,
mm-hmm.
and they re-recorded it with Dave Abruzzese. That's how you say his name, right?
Abruzzese, yeah.
Abruzzese, okay. Abruzzese.
Say it how you want, man. Is it? Hey, listen, if you ever say anything and people are like, that's not how you say it, just say, that's my accent.
That's me. That's my Canadian accent.
That's my accent, and that's how we pronounce it here in Alberta, okay?
We pronounce that letter as Z, not Z, so it's Abruzzese. Another interesting thing, Mike McCready mentioned in the solo in this song that it was him basically trying to rip off Stevie Ray Vaughan. So I've got a little back-to-back.
Nice.
I'm going to listen to a little bit of the Even Flow solo, and then we're going to hear the Stevie Ray Vaughan solo, a couple clips.
All right.
The influences. We're going to go back to the roots of rock. The cool thing about these guys is they wear that stuff on their sleeve. They don't care. They talk about it and say, yeah, that's me. That's me trying to rip off Stevie Ray Vaughan. I didn't do a real great job, but it works.
Yeah. Why is it embarrassing to try and pay homage to your heroes?
Why? Right? Here's Mike McCready. Hey, you get the idea. And Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Good choice, Mike.
If you're going to choose somebody to be, you know, influenced by, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And why wouldn't you want to bring in great guitar work from a guitar hero like that to a whole new generation? And they might later go ahead and experience Stevie Ray for themselves as well, you know?
Yeah, of course. How about the next song, Alive?
Chapter One in the Mama Sun mini opera that Eddie penned to Stone Gossard's demo tracks. It was the semi-autobiographical one for Eddie, discovering who he thought was his daddy, was not his real daddy. And, I mean, it's not on the nose again. It's just, you know, the take that little tidbit, what can I run with it?
Right.
And so that's what the story of Alive is, which later leads on to Once, where he becomes a serial killer. So obviously it's not fully autobiographical because Eddie, I don't think, has gone on to do those things. If so, we're going to have to remove someone from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
It's true.
Yeah. And what was interesting about this song is how it got twisted. And again, it's one of those things, the anthem of it, right? I'm Still Alive. It's
right.
Take what you need from this song. And for so many youth out there or just anybody in any kind of life that they're living, that, you know, you get to that point where you just try to celebrate the fact that you're still alive. You've endured all of these things, these hardships, and yet here you are, you know, you're still above ground, right? I'm still alive. And it became that kind of anthem for a generation.
Absolutely.
For Eddie and the character of the song, it's a burden. It's like, I'm still alive. And you can delve into the lyrics, I guess, and decipher all that. We don't need to go through the whole story, But something that really stuck with Ed, he's happy that people got what they needed out of it, but at the same time, it's like it's the exact opposite of the spirit I was trying to write in.
Right. Well, and I guess because it's such a catchy song is why it caught on like that, because it just feels, I mean, you just can't help but sing along to it.
Very true. And then it's another song that, well, you referenced where they struggle with even flow. This was another one that they struggled with, trying to recapture, like capture what they did on the demo.
Really?
And so ultimately they used the demo version.
Interesting.
And they just added Mike McCready's guitars on the tail end of it and said, yeah, just let her rip, buddy. And they kept the demo version because they loved that one the best.
Mm-hmm. about the guitar playing on that one?
It's fantastic. It's a beautiful riff by Stone Gossard. I love that one. I had a dream once that my mom took me over to a friend's house. She's like, you got to come and hang out with my friend's son. And so I went, all right, okay. And then it turns out, it's like, yeah, my son's in back. He's playing basketball. I go outside, and it's Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam. And he's like, hey, my band has a show tonight. Do you want to come and hang out? I was like, yeah, sure, you bet. He's like, you can stand side stage. Okay, cool. And so I'm out there. And for some reason, I get invited out on stage. Like, Stone's like, hey, man, why don't you use my guitar here? Here you go.
Yeah.
And then Eddie does the introductions of all the bandmates and says, and filling in for Stone Gossard is Master Troy Vincent. Call me Master.
Right, what, as you
what
do.
What an ego I have in my own dreams, eh? And then I just kicked into that riff.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is that one of those, do you know that? Can you play it on guitar? You're yeah. a guitar player. So is that one of those ones you sat as a kid and just learned to play?
Absolutely.
Over and over?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic little riff. It's fun.
How is that when you woke up in your dream? You seems like this is stuck in your brain. You
we jammed a little bit for that song, and then yeah, eventually I woke up and I went, "Oh my god, that wasn't real!"
Oh, you're trying to force yourself back to sleep.
Yeah, come on, get back there. This is the only chance I'll ever have to hang out with Pearl Jam. And that's when I kind of came up with this creed in my life. You know, it's better to have jammed with Pearl Jam in a dream than never to have jammed with Pearl Jam at all. And so you know, cherish those moments, whether they're in this realm or the next, right? Like whatever plane of reality you are in, hey man, you lived it and I lived that. And that was good.
This is your life affirming saying every day.
That's right.
You wake up, and, you know, today's a crappy day, but you jammed with Pearl Jam in your dreams. So,
and when it comes to the solo of Mike McCready, another one where you pay homage to your heroes. And so he does so by, you know, giving us Ace Frehley's solo from She.
Right.
Great Kiss song. And then Ace Frehley gives us that solo from The Doors.
I love the way that stuff happens.
Isn't
I
that mean, fun?
It's the basis of this show. Let's hear those. Let's do a back-to-back comparison of all three. Just a quick clip from each one. That's pretty cool.
That's really cool. The first time you hear Pearl Jam, you're like, yeah, okay, know that one. Then you hear Ace with Kiss, and you're like, put on a little smile, like, oh, yeah. And then you hear The Doors, and you just can't help, like, just, like, laugh out loud. You're like, oh, my goodness, they are so, just plaster them, line them up all on top of each other.
Yeah. I love the way that happens. I mean, completely different types of music, but the way that it changes, it's just incremental changes over time, and it becomes a completely new art form in the end.
Absolutely.
But you can take bits and pieces of it and mash them all together and have this output that's totally different.
Like if you ever copy on purpose or by accident, like it's just bound to happen.
Right.
And we have so many great songs like you've covered in Roots of Rock of where they come from and whether they're on purpose or by accident of ripoffs.
Right.
Or Let's Pay Homage to, right? You're familiar with Milk It from Nirvana?
Yes.
From In Utero, if I could say it correctly. I'm pretty sure. I like to think that Kurt Cobain set out to piece notes together that have never been pieced in that sequence ever before.
He would.
Bing, bang, bang, boom, bang, 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 bang. They just fall apart. The whole rhythm just falls apart. And
his attempt at jazz. Yeah. Experimental jazz.
And you're right. In the end, that reminds me of that acid jazz song.
Oh, he's totally ripping off that one guy. The guy does that all the time. Oh, that exact combination of notes.
Acid Andy, that jazz musician.
Acid Andy.
Yeah.
He's so jazzy. Let's bank that one for when we do In Utero. We're gonna do that in the next one of these that we do.
Okay,
but yeah, I could see Kurt Cobain doing that. Shall we move on to Why Go?
Why Go Home?
homes. He seems to be stronger, but what they want are to be.
The usual suspects on this one, playing the instruments, nothing unusual about the instrumentation. The songwriters on this are Jeff Ament for the music and Eddie Vedder on lyrics.
That drum intro, that kicks in. Like, it's simple.
Yeah.
Nothing exotic about it, but it just, the way he's just crushing.
It's primal and gets you going.
The skins. And then the Jeff comes in with his 12-string bass. His 12-string bass. Go ahead and Google a 12-string bass. I remember like seeing a 6-string bass the first time and going, that is so cool.
How do you play that?
How do you sit there and go, I need 6 more of these?
Do you have 8 hands to play that, or how does that work?
Mike McCready described the old 12-string bass like, yeah, when Jeff brought that in, he would come in and it, like a piano to the face. It was just so intense. And it appears on a few different songs.
Yeah.
And one of them is there. It's just got that rolling. And then in come the wah-wah guitars on that intro, too. Let's take a moment to really appreciate the intros on this song and the varied intros that they have on this album, this whole album.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they're masters at that. I noticed the same thing. I mean, it's always been there in my mind and present in all these songs. But, I mean, it's all these songs, if you know them, the second that first riff or drum beat or whatever it is hits, you know it because they're so distinct and they're so catchy.
Yeah.
If anything, it's the value in the album would rest solely on the intros.
You're right. You're absolutely right. If you name this tune, if you did a name that tune rendition with this album amongst fans, it would be over very, very
half
fast.
Half a bar.
Yeah. Just, you're like, done. I know. It's Wygo. Done.
We were talking about that the other day where, you know, good music, especially good rock and roll, has got to pass the Jack Black Led Zeppelin test. Right? I mean, if you can sum the song down to a gung gung jiggle, a gung gung jiggle, a bung gung jiggle, I mean, it's a good song because it just gets in you. It doesn't take much to get going. It doesn't get much to get stuck in your head.
True.
And it stays with you forever. And it's just, it hits you down in the middle part of your chest, you know? And so much of this album is like that for me.
That sort of thing?
Yes. Precisely. You put it better than I did, but yes.
And just showcasing, you know, the storytelling capabilities of Eddie in this one and just trying to, you know, you got the songs that can be just quite emotional, and the other ones that have some distinct details inspired by, you know, real life situations. In this case, a girl put in a psych ward by the family. And I guess just showcasing honesty in pain in real life. So many hair metal songs. It's like a lot of fantasy, right?
Sure.
It's talking about, you know, beach parties. There's parties and there's babes and there's beer and there's bikinis. And it's like a guy's wet dream kind of thing.
Sure.
You know? And those are the lives that we want. And there's nothing wrong with singing about that, right?
Sure.
Hey, fantasy's great. Escapism. It's important.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
need that. But at some point, you also do have to face reality. And I think Eddie just takes that approach to it. You have to confront it. And he confronts it head on in a lot of the songs that they do.
Do you remember the movie The Wrestler?
Yeah.
Do you remember the scene where he talks about that? He's in the bar drinking, and it's like the 80s are ending, the 90s are starting. He's this 80s metal guy, and there's this grunge scene. There's all these, you know, depressed grunge rockers. And he's like, what's wrong with having a good time, man? And he just wants to party. that what you just said reminds me of that scene. It was a change. Like, you know, you hear stories of, I've read like Slash's book, and he talks about touring with Guns N' Roses and then going on tour with Soundgarden. And there's pictures of the guys from Soundgarden on stage, and they have this look of, what the hell are you doing? Because Axl and Slash or somebody are out there with like a blow-up doll, and they're trying to prank them while they're playing, and they're like, this is serious, man. We're depressed. You don't have fun.
Don't mess with my art.
Yeah, I got to look that picture up, and I'll post it on the Roots of Rock Twitter, and I'll send it to you because it's so telling. It's like that, again, the scene in The Wrestler and that picture that shows them just, what are you doing? We're not here to have a good time. We're serious.
Got to get the message out. And there's not like there's one right approach.
No.
You know, you need that balance, that yin and yang. And so there's room in the world for both of them. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. The other thing that I noticed was I dug up an interview with Eddie where he was explaining the meaning of this song. And as you mentioned, it's about a girl who gets put into a psychiatric hospital unfairly because her mother's convinced by psychiatrists that she should be put there, whether right or wrong for her, to make her better. Something really struck me, though, when I was reading the interview was that you mentioned how Eddie has a way of coming up with lyrics so fast, and he's better at expressing himself in song form than he is in person, I think.
Oh, God, yes.
I mean, I heard him trying to describe the theme and the lyrics behind the song, and I thought, I was almost better off when I just read the lyrics and listened to the song. It connected more with me than hearing him say that.
He captures it better in his poem than he does
100%
giving you a paragraph.
100%. Yeah, it's like I could probably hear this guy talk for an hour, and in this 3-minute rock song, it's going to be more effective on me and make me angrier and more, you know, sympathetic to this cause by hearing that one song, even by the lyrics, but combine that with the music. And it was kind of an interesting thing.
It's a super skill. It's his weakness, talking. He's such a quiet talker too. And then his superpower, his lyrics, and his ableness to wail.
That's right. Black.
That's powerful. That's a lyric. People are going, what? I don't remember that one from the album. That was a little extra one from Atlanta 1994.
Live version.
Yeah. I'll delve into that here momentarily. It's a song that the producers, record company said, hey, we have to put this one out as a single. This is a beautiful, beautiful ballad. We got this one. Let's do the ballad. And the band said, no, we are not going to be doing that whatsoever. Some songs... Ed said, quote, some songs just aren't meant to be played between hit number 2 and number 3. Actually, Ed said, some songs just aren't meant to be played between hit number 2 and number 3.
It's a pretty good impression.
What's that? What's that, Eddie? And he says, you start doing those things, you're going to crush them. Not in yeah, dude, you crushed it. Woo! No, not that way. It's like, you're going to wreck it.
Right.
And so don't do it. Of course, the popularity of the song, fans were just so savage for that ballad, and it was a powerful one, stood out immediately from the album, that they called into radio stations, said, can you please play this one? Can you please play this one? And so station programmers said, we're going to go ahead and play this like it's an actual release, like a single. And it charted, and it went high.
Radio jerks.
One of those most popular songs on the charts on Pearl Jam, kind of by accident, or as determined by the fans.
I love the fact about Pearl Jam is that they... You know, there's several different instances where you can talk about that, where they've taken a stand. And I mean, in this case, obviously, it worked out opposite from maybe what they had expected. But they could still stand by their decisions and what they, you know, deemed important as far as the art and the music goes.
Yeah, and you would have been forced to make a video for it back then, right? And,
yep.
And that's something they didn't want to do. It was way too personal of a song for Ed. And when you can delve into it, if you read it, I guess one interpretation, it's about abortion, having to go and do that. That's why when you got the lyrics surrounded by kids at play and I can hear their laughter, so why do I sear, you know? It's the reminder of an unborn child, you know? That's not what the song meant to me, and that's the beauty of a well-written song, of course. It can mean many things to different people. And the line I related to the most was, I know someday you'll have a beautiful life. I know you'll be a star in someone else's sky, but why? Can it be mine? You know, having to let go of a love that you want to hold on to forever, I think is a theme that so many people can relate to.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think then you get further insight into it with the actual line that we played there that he throws in the live concert in Atlanta in 1994 is, I don't think these people understand no, they don't understand that we belong together. We belong together. And just the passion and the roar that he sings with, is just, he bleeds that song every time in concert. This is why he needs to drink wine. He just shows up at the start. Here's my bottle of wine. I need this. It's my coping mechanism tonight. I'm going to go into dark places.
That's right.
Yeah.
Probably so emotionally spent by the end of every concert.
Absolutely. That's why he's a low talker.
Because he's got he has to save it.
No more energy left in him at that point. This was also a song right at the start with that another classic one. As soon as that EQ'd guitar begins, the producer hated the start of the song. He just didn't like the sound of that acoustic guitar. And so he's like, I'm just going to EQ this to the tilt completely. And then that's when the warm bass comes in. Boom, ba-dunksh, and everything just warms up.
I love that sound. It gets me every time.
That's a great start to the song, that's for sure. And then it also makes me reminisce of that one line. My girlfriend would always muffle my mouth as I tried to sing. Her legs spread out before me. She's like, that's not appropriate. Don't you dare sing. Who are you singing about?
It's not who I'm singing about. It's who Eddie's singing about.
That's right. Yeah, it's a magnificent song. And you're right. The fans lifted that one up to become a radio single. And I think that the band would kind of be proud of that.
I think Pearl Jam fans, especially the hardcore ones, they really love that stuff because a lot of their stuff is played even to this day so heavily, their singles and the hits. You know, when people go to see them, they go nuts for the stuff that aren't the singles, you know, the B-sides and the rarities and the overseas releases and stuff like that, because it's the stuff that I'm sure a lot of people feel. It's like anybody who loves a band. I mean, it's the stuff that you know that the surface fans don't know, right?
I still remember Stone Gossard saying, I don't want to play Even Flow 20 years from now, back in 1992.
Right.
Like, guess what? You're going to be playing Even Flow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's like, I can't believe, how do the Rolling Stones do it, playing their hits like that? Well, you're going to find out. And they still play it to this day. You have to.
Yeah.
I noticed that they play a speedier version in concert, I find.
Oh, really? Yeah, got to get through it, right?
Yeah, hey, let's make this five-minute song 3:45. How about that? Let's give her.
At least it's not like Bob Dylan where he just completely changes the song. It's like, yeah, these are the same lyrics, but not the same chords, not the same melody. Lyrics, that's about it. And everything is different.
And you get attached more than to just the words, you know?
Oh, yeah, 100%. When you can't sing along, you go, I don't know why I paid money for this, Bob. I'd deal with a faster version. That would be fine. Faster version of something, especially if it's something like that's been played a million times.
Yeah, and it's up-tempo and gets you rocking.
Yeah.
There's no crime in that.
No, absolutely. All right, Jeremy.
Right there. Those harmonics, a ping pong. Love that. That rolling bass line. Another great intro for Pearl Jam.
Another one.
Masters.
Again, we're limited to 30 seconds, so I wanted to play the intro. It's so iconic, but I wanted a bit of the chorus in there too, so you do what you got to do. Sounds a bit butchered, but it works, kind of.
Yeah.
Not really.
Blame the producer. It's Sean.
It's me. Sean. Don't tell anyone.
Okay.
Come closer. Bring your ear closer to my...
Smack!
So lyrics, obviously, written by Eddie Vedder again. This one's written again by Jeff Ament. There's a cello in this one. I think this one also features the 12-string bass. It's kind of a combination. The story is written about a kid named Jeremy Dell, a 15-year-old sophomore in high school, who killed himself with a Smith & Wesson revolver in front of his class. And so that's the first part. But the part that I didn't really know was that there was kind of a combination where there was a kid that shot up a class in Eddie Vedder's high school. And so he kind of combined his experience with what his memories of that kid, you know, and then equating that to this Jeremy and putting the two together. And that's why there's kind of this interaction that, you know, because if you didn't know the second part, that this actually happened in or something not quite as the same, but a similar situation with a gun in high school in Eddie's school, you'd think, well, you know, he's just he's just injecting himself into this Jeremy Kidd story, and he kind of is, but he has a personal experience with it that he was able to combine.
He's got something biographical to throw himself into.
Totally. And so he's, you know, he's, there's the guilt of having treated, you know, that kid that way growing up, or what he remembers. And I'm sure we all have that. We're all jerks when we're kids, and we're probably jerks to other kids at some point. And when it,
you might not even know that you're doing it at the time, right?
No, but anybody who looks back, I mean, there's things where, whether it's regret or not, I don't know, but you, especially when it culminates into something that's so violent and horrific, how could that not force a person to look back and go, oh my God, did I have a hand in that? Was it part of me? And I was just lucky I wasn't in that classroom that day or whatever, right? So,
what was it for Eddie? He was, I can't remember the exact classroom. Is he an oceanography class or something? What was that? I can't remember. I remember reading it once upon a time and going, you had that in school? That was an option for you? That's a cool class. Cool school, man.
I think it was oceanography or something that you would only probably ever get on a coastal city school, right?
Yeah. Over the prairies, we're not delving into that too much.
No.
I remember the video was an excellent video, but I remember someone coming up to Eddie and saying, I hate your video for that song. That's not what I took away from the song. I'm like, I don't know what else you're supposed to take away from the song. There's a clear story in this one.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, you ruined it for me. And Eddie was just like hurt by that. He's like, oh, that's not what we want at all. Stupid videos. And so that's why they decided, like, well, I don't want to do videos here anymore. They're very reluctant to ever participate. But it did give us the single video theory years later, where they gave us that special, just big full. I remember owning the VH copy of it.
Right.
VHS copy of
it. Yeah.
And so thanks, jerk, who didn't like that Jeremy video, because you got us, you know, we missed out on some other videos, but you got us this one giant one, which is kind of cool.
Well, and it was that video that made the song blow up. Like it was a good song to begin with, but when that MTV got a hold of that and the two together, I mean, that, and then that thing was played on loop. I had peasant vision living in the country at the time, but even I knew about the video. Everybody knew about that video. If you're between the ages of, you know, I don't know, 10 and whatever, 10 and up or something in that era, you knew that video.
And then prior to that, it was live, you know, footage of them performing Even Flow and Alive. And so it was their first real crack at of like, here's something artistic that we're going to tie into this. And you're right. That's what really just made the band blow up and put them on the world stage.
Yeah. Oceans.
Side two.
Hold on to the throne. The currents will shift. Glide me to.
This was a song that I grew to love. I didn't love it out of the chute. Didn't hate it, but just didn't love it. I wasn't in a situation where I was felt extremely far away from the places and people that I loved. But once that happened, when I was like 16, I went and lived somewhere else, and I was suddenly away from those things. That song just struck a chord with me a lot, to the point where I went to some gypsy store, right? They got beads and everything like that, and little trinkets or things that you can do to make like necklaces or bracelets or whatever.
Sure.
And so a girlfriend at the time was, you know, getting some stuff, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to go ahead. I found some alphabet stuff. I'm like, what would I spell? And the first thing that came to mind was oceans. And so I made a little oceans necklace with some beads and stuff. And I wore that for years.
Cool.
And then I lost it. And it got to the point where I even considered getting a tattoo of the word oceans right under my throat.
Yeah.
Because that's where I was so used to wearing that necklace.
Right.
And that song just strikes such a chord with me now.
Huh. Cool.
Yeah. But the actual roots of the writing of this song is phenomenal. Are you familiar with that story?
Vaguely. Why don't you tell us?
They're jamming and they're in rehearsals, and someone says, Ed, can you please go put out some change into the parking meter for me? Yeah. Oh, I can do that, no problem. And so he goes outside and he does that, and it's raining and he doesn't have his coat. And so he rushes back in and the door is locked. He can't get inside, but he does have a pen and paper. And so while he's stranded outside, knocking and pounding, but he can hear the band's jamming, so what's the point? He decides to pull out the paper and he writes lyrics for that bass line that he's hearing through the wall and through the door that Jeff is jamming on. And so they finally go, where's Ed? What's taking him so long? Open up the door. There's soaking wet Eddie. And he's like, by the way, I got some lyrics here. Let's play that one again. And they're like, what? You wrote a song in minutes? Like, and they're like, and again, it comes back to his songwriting that they're always mesmerized by is the fact that it's like, you sit there and go, yeah, we got something here. Let's work on this. This is a work in progress. And it's like, no, you've hit it, man. Like, this is, we're not going to influence and try to inject something else into this. You've nailed it. Here we go. This is our new song.
And that would never happen nowadays. That could never happen because multiple reasons, but that Eddie gets locked out. He just sends a text or calls on a cell phone. And while he's waiting, he's not writing a song. He's browsing the internet. He's wasting time. I mean, that's an awesome story. It does harken back to that time, though, because, you know, in the 90s, you would have, if you were a songwriter, you would probably travel with a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper because you've got, when you're inspired, you got to write. Where, I mean, we all think that we have something to write on when we're inspired, but we never write that stuff down now because you go on your phone. It's like, well, I could write lyrics to a song or I can.
Oh, what's this over here? Yeah.
Oh, YouTube?
I got a text, though. What's up?
Look at that. I checked some email. Oh, hey, guys, I'm back in.
Yeah, now it takes some real discipline. You're right. Yeah. That's a magical song, and it was the first song that I ever heard live in concert.
Really?
And my soul cried, I'm pretty sure, when all of a sudden that started. I knew they were going to start with a slow song. They love doing that. That's their thing. It's their signature. Maybe that's why the album itself starts off with that little sleepy Master Slave intro into Once. And when they started just strumming it just right away, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is the first song that I get to hear live in concert.
Yeah, yeah.
Worshiping this band for like 14 years at this point.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
And it speaks again to his songwriting genius that even just not even being immersed in a song and feeling it and experiencing it and being with his bandmates while they're playing it and be able to write lyrics for something you're listening to through a wall.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
He felt oceans away, even though there was just a door between him and the band.
A little love song I wrote about my surfboard.
From the MTV Unplugged. Good old Eddie.
I love how soft-spoken he is when he's not singing. Like if you met him and you were hanging out with him, whatever, you're getting a coffee, you're walking down the street and you're having a beer, he's just like, this is a love song about my surfboard.
Hey guys, this is our new lead singer. He's Eddie. Really? This is the guy? This is the guy who's going to be shouting into a microphone for
this
you?
This is their front man, the guy who's going to command thousands of people at once. They can't even hear him across his coffee table.
Yeah, but you expect him to really control the room. Yes, he can.
Yeah. And even to go from when he's speaking in a microphone. He's very soft-spoken, and this is a love song about my surfboard. Hey, yeah! It's awesome.
It's magical.
Porch.
And the cross I'm bearing home, it ain't taken till both my place. Left the porch, left the porch. Oh. Hear my name, take a good look. This could be the day for my death. Walk beside me, I just need.
So this one's written by Eddie, music and lyrics on this one.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a love song, kind of about maybe unrequited love or being in love with someone and them not telling you. There's quotes of him playing this song live and saying, if you love someone, tell him. So, you know, to me, that means I picture him standing on a porch with someone who he thinks loves him and they don't say it. And so he has to leave and he has to go.
Porch. Eddie loves singing about porches, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Sings about in this one, in Breath, from the single soundtrack. You got, he suggests you step out on the porch. Yellow Ledbetter, he sees people out on the porch and they don't wave. Jerks. There's something about the porch. The porch is either an important symbol or a literal object structure in Eddie's life that he just keeps gravitating back towards back then.
Yeah, and it could be something, you know, it could be a bit of a throwback. I mean, it is, you notice nowadays, and I don't know, maybe it's the way neighborhoods are built or what, I don't know, but porches, I think, used to be a bigger part of of life in general, just day-to-day life. I mean, nobody hangs out on porches anymore, but people used to a lot. In like I say, maybe it was the way, maybe it's in bigger cities, I don't know. But I mean, I know in any neighborhood I've ever lived in my almost 40 years in Canada anyway, several different cities, I can never picture anyone sitting on a porch and hanging out. But in those days, that would have seemed a little bit more normal, I think. And so a lot of life would happen there.
Yeah, I'm from out east, and I go back and see the family there. There's not a lot of porches per se, maybe a tiny little deck, but often they'll just have a chair out in the front yard, and everyone would just hang out in the front yard and treat it that way.
Right.
Something that just doesn't happen
anymore.
And if you go into old neighborhoods of cities, you'll see a lot of the old houses. They got nice, beautiful verandas and
sure.
everything like that. And once upon a time, those used to be used more than just putting your old washing machine out there. Hey, there's room for more junk. Great.
So this song has that instrumental break that they lengthen when they play live, and that used to be the part where Eddie would do his acrobatics and climb and get to places where everybody thought he was going to die because he would climb so high on scaffolding and lighting and rigging. And he's even said himself, you know, he got himself into some, he just started looking around for something to climb, and next thing you know, he's 40 feet up and going, now what?
Where do I go from here? I got to get down somehow and finish the song. And yeah, now he doesn't get so airborne. He'll just break out some tambourines and start hitting those and throw those out into the crowds.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't have a choice except for to, you know, not climb as high when you're older and more breakable.
I don't want to get back spasms. I don't want to have a spasm mid-climb here.
I'm just going to throw things. I found a really cool website, actually, when I was digging around and researching for the show. Have you ever heard of this thing called setlist.fm?
No. Oh, you know what? Yeah, I've come across that.
Have you? Yeah, it's really cool.
It
talks about how many times a song has been played live. And I don't know how they track it. I guess listeners reporting or I don't know. I mean, maybe it's in here if I looked a little deeper, but I guess it would be hard to say how exactly accurate it is, or if they just have an algorithm that scans the internet for people that post set lists or people submit it. I don't know. But it's really cool because it tells you all the artists that have played this song and how many times each one have played it live. So Pearl Jam, according to setlist.fm, has played that song live 580 times. Eddie's done it solo 141 times.
Wow.
The third next most on that list is No Code, the Pearl Jam tribute band, 18 times. The Seattle Grunge Experience. And then there's a band called Angry Hair that's played it 3 times. And Pearl Jammed, Pearl Jam UK. There's a lot of...
I've never delved into the stats like that, the advanced stats, the analytics. I've only ever come across that when I'm looking for like an actual set list. I'm like, oh, was that the concert there? And I can't remember what order they played this in.
Sure.
Or I was at that show, and what was the song they played off that album? And then you go back and you find it really quick that way.
It's interesting. As I'm looking at this one too, there's a vertical graph, and so it's chronological, starting in the past. No, sorry, that's wrong. No, I'm wrong on that. It shows it from most to last. And so like in 1992, they played that song 107 times.
Yeah.
1991, 93. But then the next most was 2014. It's like there was a resurgence of that song in 2014 for some reason. That's interesting.
Bringing it back.
Garden.
I will.
Stone Gossard's favorite song on the album.
Really?
Mine too, buddy. I think it's mine as well. Yeah. Stone loved it for the simplicity, the arrangement on it. And Jeff Ament loved that song so much. He's a big fan of that one as well.
Why do you like it? Why is it yours?
I could never get a grasp of the full picture of this song when it comes to trying to interpreting one. It's not a flat out storyline like some of the other songs that they have. It's like a lot of imagery. I couldn't grasp how each line was tethered to the next. You know, each line could resonate to something, you know, each one could actually resonate to something. You could feel something from it. You could pick this out of your own life and go, yeah, this is what it means to me, but never a complete picture. And I was never clever enough to actually decipher the code The music, that's what it was for me. It's haunting. It's magnetic. The solo in that from Mike McCready it's bluesy. And Mike just shows you what you can do by using the empty space. It doesn't have to be filled with chords and notes being slammed together all the time and endlessly. You know, you got some empty space. You let things breathe. You let the chords resonate. You let there be sustained. The effects, you do a little effects on it with the solo on Stone's riff. And Stone's riff is the glue, the framework within where Mike's solo can wander and layer across. And it brings me to tears pretty much every time, I think.
Yeah?
I get a little choked up, yeah.
Good thing we didn't play more than 30 seconds of
sometimes
it.
It's sadness, sometimes it's awe and bewilderment and how the notes are like speaking a language. I can understand the guitar language of Mike McCready in that song more than I can understand the lyrics themselves.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Others say it's about religion, it's about lost faith. Eddie apparently referenced it being about the Gulf War, which would have been happening at the time that Pearl Jam was breaking out and doing their songwriting. The modern need for oil that's so strong that you'll go to war for it and have innocent lives taken because of it. I don't see either, like, any of those in the song. I'm blind to the meaning of that song. And if I was ever finding myself sitting with Eddie and I had a chance to ask him what that song meant, I would not ask him whatsoever.
Some songs are better left unsaid that way.
Don't need to know, yeah. And every time I listen to that song, I wish that it never ended. I love it.
Oh my God, I love songs like that.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Deep. Above her, she just ain't nothing. And she doesn't like the view. She doesn't like the view. She doesn't like the view. But he thinks himself deep. So songwriters on that one are Stone Gossard and Jeff Ament. They wrote the music. That's a pretty dark song as well. They touch on, I think rape, intravenous drug use, cutting maybe. We talked about the Doors' influence on Mike McCready, especially earlier. Well, sort of as a backdoor influence, right? Via Ace Frehley. But I would venture a guess that in some ways the band is influenced by the Doors. And this one really reminds me of that. It reminds me of that, you know, the killer went down the hallway and mother, you know, like that whole theme of that song. It's kind of got that same feeling to it. Maybe not the storyline, but just the feeling of the song.
I think it's a sign of Eddie being ahead of the times. You know, 26 years before the Me Too, hashtag Me Too movement, there was Deep by Pearl Jam on the album 10.
Yeah. It's a very, there's a lot of dynamics in this song too. They really use the loud, quiet, loud. It's just the discordant guitars, like they kind of play off each other in a clangy kind of way, but it works. And then also the dynamics, like the hook of the song is catchy, but when it gets back to the sort of the verses and the guitars, it's sort of jarring, right? And it's not meant to be a feel-good song, that's for sure.
It's another one of the 12-string bass songs from Jeff Ament.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember my buddy Dean, when he got his first wah-wah pedal, and we rushed back to the jam space and plugged it in, and this was like a go-to song for like, hey, we can finally play this with the wah-wah. Like, of all the great wah-wah songs that are out there in the riffs that we absolutely took the time to learn immediately or play immediately after
Jimi Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And we loved those songs. We played all those songs all the time. For some reason, this was the first one. We're like, hey, look, the market.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, wow.
Funny. All right. What's next?
Release. This was just an open jam in rehearsal that took on a life of its own. Originally 10 minutes long. They were just kind of jamming and jamming and let it go. And Eddie stepped up to the microphones, got most of the lyrics right off the bat. It harkens back to the autobiographical portion of Alive, where, you know, he's similar to his dad and just dealing with that. He wants to be free of that connection. And so that release was important for him. And then you had the other band members, Jeff and Stone, who had lost their lead singer, Andrew Wood, from Mother Love Bone, and they wanted to feel a release of what they felt from having to deal with that, the pain and being, you know, tethered to that so strongly, and just find some sort of release. And so it spoke to the band, and so that's why it was a must to be on the album.
All right, and we've got some, we're going to touch quickly on the a couple of songs that were only released in the UK, or yeah, European version at least. Anyway, we North American listeners might not be, I wasn't as familiar. I mean, I knew of them, but I wasn't that familiar with them. There's Wash and there's Dirty Frank. Mm-hmm. So let's hear a little of Wash first.
Oh, was the time like a clean new taste, smiling eyes before me, inches from my face.
Great tune. I remember hearing it for the first time and just being jealous that it wasn't on my rendition of 10, that's for sure.
Yeah. I like that the, you know, it's got that relatively clean guitar sound on it. It's just it's a bit of a departure from the rest of the album, where everything's pretty crunchy and gritty, and it's just a, again, there's a bit of a dynamic, right? It makes for a different style of song, different feeling, because it doesn't have the exact same instrumentation as a lot of the stuff on the album.
Yeah, very popular B-side. When it comes to something that's very different, stands out from the rest of the album, I say we get right to Dirty Frank. Unless mm-hmm. you have something else on Wash that you'd like to talk about.
No, let's do it.
Let's get the Dirty Frank.
Got a rest of people in a single suit, yeah. Wanted a pass, so she relaxed. Now the little baby's getting chopped up in the back. I got a cover full of fleshy, fresh ingredients. I'm very careful in the same not quite expedient. It's meat, a release. Bus driving's hotter on your head than on your feet. Dirty Frank. A Dirty Frank, girl.
Dirty Frank's the serial killer from Once.
Maybe, hey. So that one's actually written by Jeff Ament, Stone Gossard, Mike McCready, Eddie Vedder, and Dave Abruzzese. Dave Crewson, the drummer's replacement, right?
Yeah.
So, right, the story goes that they were touring with Red Hot Chili Peppers at the time, and which you can, I think you can hear the
you got a little funk in
influence in that song. And Dave Abruzzese was the guy, as I mentioned, who replaced Dave Crewson. Dave Crewson had, you know, there's some incidents at some release parties or whatever, and he ended up going to rehab, couldn't tour with the band, so they found this guy, Dave Abruzzese, who actually happened to play in a funk band as well. So he had that background, right? And apparently it was the guys just messing around on the bus. And, you know, what if our bus driver was a cannibalistic serial killer?
Yeah, they said he was funny? They said he was a little off. Frank, bus driver Frank's a little off. What if? Like, they woke up one time and found like beer cans or something like that underneath the bus driver's seat. And like, what? They're in a new city and like, can I smell your breath, please? And, so they kind of just went into this little daydream and came up with this quite interesting song that, to me, I'm glad this one wasn't actually on our album over here. Cause I love the song, but it's so different and
it's kind of goofy. It's kind of funny, right?
Just, but to me, it just doesn't belong on the album.
Totally. Yeah. It maybe as like a hidden track or something, if you found on there, it would be hilarious.
Yeah. It's a great B-side.
It's like All By Myself with Green Day. I mean, they're not as serious of a band, I guess. Yeah. Right. But my only thing with that song is that Dirty Frank doesn't quite fit with, you know, it's like if a guy's a serial killing cannibal that eats kids and stuff, Dirty quite doesn't quite do it justice.
Yeah, he's not telling dirty jokes. That's Dirty Frank.
He's not a guy who sleeps with a lot of women. That would be Dirty Frank.
Cannibalistic Frank.
Guess it doesn't have the same ring to it. But.
Fleshy Frank. I don't know. I just love when they're... Dirty Frank, he's one bad mother. Shut your mouth. We're talking about Dirty Frank.
I like it though. It's a different side of the band, right? It's cool to hear that, you know, when they're on tour and doing that kind of thing. They just have fun. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, they may be serious on stage. They may be writing serious themes and songs and whatnot and lyrics, but you know, there's still guys, there's still people who like to have fun, right?
Where's Mike McCready?
Oh my God, he's been eight.
And then into the hidden track of Master Slave, The Return, if you will. That was a track that always put me in the mood to hear the album all over again. And it's, I don't know if it was intentional, but the cleverness is when that starts up, I'm waiting to hear those tingy guitars again of Once come back in and start the album all over. And I'm ready. I'm resetting. Let's do this.
I hear you, man. Me too.
Yeah.
And it is. And I've been listening to this album on repeat since we started talking about doing this. Every road trip, I gotta play it a couple of times. It's really, really cool to go back and listen to it again.
Go back and hear it and just go, wow, holy reverb.
Yeah.
Like it didn't stand out when the album was first released, because it was normal to have lots of reverb back in rock and roll back
then.
And the band even speaks about, you know, going back and like, oh, I wish we could just, you know, strip the reverb back a little bit. And they've did some re-releases, of course, tried to get rid of some of that.
Yeah, that's kind of some of the stuff that I think they did. And it is really interesting to hear. It's kind of like, watching HD and watching a VHS. Like, you didn't notice it at the time, but when you go back in retrospect and you get used to something else that's a lot cleaner and you go back and see it, it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah, and then once you start listening to it again, like, you start ignoring it, like it goes away.
Yeah.
You absorb it like you once did.
Yeah.
But if you've taken a break from it, it really stands out, that's for sure. Some of the songs that didn't make the cut: Breath, State of Love and Trust, State of Love or Trust. That's an amazing song. I know you're a big fan of that one. Alone, Brother almost broke up the entire band because Jeff wanted it on the album as a song written by Stone, and he just got tired of it. He's like, well, we have enough mid-tempo songs, so let's not put it on there. And Jeff lost his head and like blew up and said, no, we're going to put this on the album or else I'm out. It's either this song and me or I'm gone. So he actually went back outside and like slam dunking balls with ferocity and anger and kind of blew some steam off, and then came in and, you know, they eventually said, no, okay, we'll leave it off of there. Just a Girl, Evil Little Goat. Go take a listen to that one sometime. Yellow Ledbetter. And then Footsteps is also one that didn't make the cut.
And I think a lot of those they did release later on the Lost Dogs, Rarity albums, stuff like that, right? You could pick up a lot of that stuff on some of those.
Yeah, absolutely.
We should do one of those at another point and do in-depth trivia, history, all that stuff. Thoughts on those ones.
Thanks for letting me join you on this journey of Pearl Jam 10, buddy.
Thanks again, buddy.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for checking out the Roots of Rock Jam Session for April 2018. The Jam Sessions are exclusive to the podcast, so be sure to subscribe and never miss an episode. Speaking of content that's exclusive to podcast listeners, we're doing something new that I really want to tell you about. It's really cool. Podcast listeners are going to love it. See, in podcast form, for a variety of ridiculous reasons, we can only play 30-second clips or less of music clips. As you've probably noticed, it's all due to legalities and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, I thought it would be cool to create Spotify playlists of all the music featured in the full feature podcast episodes, and really cool for the Jam Session features like the one you just heard with Troy and I today. So, if you head over to the Roots of Rock Twitter, you can find all kinds of links to Spotify playlists that we've curated that will get you even deeper into the music. So, listen to the podcast, then go listen to the playlist, and you'll hear stuff in the music you've never noticed before. It's a really cool experience, so I highly recommend you check it out. Of course, you can check it out on Spotify and just search Roots of Rock, and you'll find it there as well. Stay tuned for the beginning of May when we will have a brand new Roots of Rock podcast and tons of cool stuff coming up as always. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter at Roots of Rock ST is our handle, and subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you like to listen to us on. Thanks for hanging out. Rock and roll!